At Audi Columbus, luxury meets convenience. Family-owned since 1897, we've built our reputation on trust, transparency, and innovation. Browse our selection online and complete your purchase from home. Then simply stop by to pick up your keys.
Drive home a new 2025 Audi Q6 e-tron for $499 for 36 months with $5,295 down.
The next generation shops online. Experience the future with us at AudiColumbus.com. Buyers Auto, driving the next generation of buyers.
See dealer for details. Offer ends 9/30/25.
Skyline's new chicken chili is here. Now you can enjoy that legendary Skyline taste with a new protein option. Try Skyline's chicken chili on Waze, Coney's, and all your Skyline favorites. Feeling good. It's Skyline time.
Today we welcome Cadmus to the Hadean podcast, author of Every Necuamantia is a Catabasis, Ancient Insights for Contemporary Goetic Practice, which can be found within the collection of works published by Hadean Press as Conja Codex 5, a wonderful anthology of essays from some of the leading figures in modern occulture. In this episode, which really feels like a continuation of my previous conversations with Dr. Al Cummings and Carl Nordblom, Cadmus and I discuss the concepts of catabasis, or the descent into the underworld, the importance of mythic narrative, and the internal landscapes and dramatis personae which inhabit our magical materia, and how we, the sorcerer, may engage with living stories to effectuate our magical practice. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and I am very happy to welcome Cadmus to the Hadean Press podcast.
Cadmus, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on, Matt. This is great, and I'm very excited.
First of all, Cadmus, could you introduce yourself and give our listeners an idea of your background in the study and practice of magic?
Yes, absolutely. My pen name is Cadmus. I go by Cadmus. My day job, I'm a professor of philosophy. So when not discussing these kinds of stuff, I'm discussing philosophy with my students. In terms of my background in the study and practice of magic, I should stress the fact that I've never been initiated into any organization, so I have no sort of official ranks or anything like that. Some people really care about that, so I always want to be upfront. I'm not attempting to imply I have any initiatory power that I don't have, but I've been studying and practicing magic most of my life. And a lot of my story is probably pretty familiar. So I self-initiated into Wicca in grade school when I was in eighth grade, if I remember right, which ends up meaning I've been doing this about 30 years, if we start counting from there. From there in high school, I got very involved in sort of neo-paganism. I moved away from Wicca, but I also started reading things like Agrippa. I first started reading him in high school, but also I started devouring Crowley and Thelema and Golden Dawn materials in high school. So by the time I left high school, I was sort of a committed ceremonial magician in a roughly Golden Dawn Thelemic sort of style. And then that continued through college, right? That was roughly sort of my approach through college. It wasn't until graduate school where things started to shift for me. And I started to, on the one hand, go back to my polytheist and pagan roots. There were always gods that I had maintained a relationship with. I had never lost that relationship, but I had been thinking in terms of much more abstract, complex systems up until graduate school. So I had been working a lot with Enochian magic and, you know, a fairly sort of traditional ceremonial magic type stuff. In grad school, sort of, I began shifting towards back towards polytheism more. And also by the end of graduate school, I became a lot more interested in folk magic ish approaches. Sort of a grimoire work, but grimoire work that had a less ceremonial magic, sort of a high magic feel, and more of a sort of, I guess, witchcraft and folk magic feel. So I've been doing that kind of stuff, polytheism, more folk magic approach to grimoires, and necromancy for quite a while now.
So we are discussing your amazing essay from Hadean Press's Conjure Codex 5, titled Every Necromantia is a Catabasis: Ancient Insights for Contemporary Goetic Practice. Now, before we move on, I think it's pretty important that we nail down some of these definitions. Could you explain something of the concepts mentioned in this wonderful title?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And we had mentioned this in the pre-talk before we got going, but my pronunciation of Greek is famously bad. I do read ancient Greek and I do translate ancient Greek, but both in college when I started studying it and in graduate school, I was widely made fun of for how bad my pronunciation is. So I never want to be seen as guiding anyone else's pronunciation. But yeah, so the two sort of key words, other than goetia, which or goetic practice, which we'll get to, I think, a bit later. But the two key words there are necromantia and catabasis, right? So what are we talking about here? Necromantia is a word that became sort of associated just with necromancy in general in the ancient Greek world. So if you look up, terms that can mean necromancy, necromantia is one of them. But it's got a slightly more complicated history than that too. There were temples in ancient Greece called Necromantion, and they were places where you would go and you would consult with the dead. So you would very often there were caves or there were temples connected to caves. Sometimes the practice involved things like sleeping in the temple, and the dead would come to you and answer questions and things like that. And that becomes a term for a type of necromancy that specifically has to do with consulting with the dead. Rather than simply if you look at like cursed tablet work, a lot of cursed tablets, you're not like summoning forth a spirit and you're not talking with them. You're just sort of giving the dead some direction of something you want them to do. Necromantia is more you want to interact with the dead. So ritual with the goal being interaction with the dead. And catabasis is, not just a magical term. You find it in literature and sort of the history of religion. The idea of a catabasis, it just means literally going down, right? It's a going down where? Going down to the underworld. So very famously, there are collections of different examples of catabasis going to the underworld. Right? So the rough argument of this paper is that every time we engage in necromancy, every time we attempt to speak with the dead, we are also engaged in a process of going to the underworld. That the two are connected and unavoidably so. That speaking with the dead and visiting the dead, literally in their space, is sort of an unavoidable connection. And I think that that informs a lot of, or could or should inform a lot of ritual practice, right? Things like protections that we have in mind and other sort of ritual considerations are tied into what you would want to keep in mind if you were traveling to the land of the dead, traveling to the underworld.
When we're talking about Goetia in this context, we aren't discussing the book of that name found in the Lamegeton. We're talking about the ancient necromantic and chthonic roots of Greek magic. Could you describe something of this practice? And I know you just mentioned the there were specific locations in Greece where people would commune with the dead. You see a lot of that same kind of technology or technique being discussed in the PGM and potentially even surviving into the late Middle Ages in the European grimoires. Could you elaborate further on that point?
So I'm gonna put the PGM topic just to the side for a moment, just so I remember to get to it. But yeah, Goetia in general, right? It's a term that derives from classical Greece. It predates classical Greece, but we find it textually, historically in classical Greece. And by the time it shows up in classical Greece, it's already being used as a term to denigrate various practices, right? So we sort of find it after it's already out of favor with the powers that be. So, for example, we find it in Plato and others, and it usually points towards some sort of unseemly practice. And it ends up being part of this very big dualism that gets developed, or big sort of a contrast that gets developed between Goetia and Thergy, right? And Theurgy or Thergy, right, is a way of reaching to the gods, whereas Goetia is dirty and earthly and has practical concerns and all that stuff that truly high-minded people shouldn't care about. Now, that's sort of the official story until we dig a bit further beyond what our textual history alone can sort of give us, right? So when you dig a bit further, from my perspective at least, I don't think we can understand Goetia until we think about the Greek Dark Ages, right? The ancient Greek Dark Ages. So what happens is that there is the Mycenaean civilization, right? This was a palace civilization. They had large sort of centers of population. They had, complex economic and trade systems, and so on and so forth. And they had priests, right? They had official people who filled the role of priest. Okay, now this is the civilization that goes to war with Troy, right? The story of the Trojan War is the story of the Mycenaeans attacking the city of Troy and so on. Now, this civilization collapses. And when it collapses, Greece loses what little system of writing they had. The Mycenaeans had a system of writing. They primarily used it for bookkeeping and things like that, but all writing is lost. We know that centers of population are entirely depopulated, right? So, I mean, imagine just sort of empty cities, we'll say, but centers of population totally destroyed, totally depopulated. You end up with really a very serious collapse of society and a dark age period. It's during that period, in my opinion, that we really have to think about the rise of Galicia, right? Because you've got a society, a civilization, that obviously is in free fall. But as it begins to get back on its feet and put itself back together, it needs, every society has them, some sort of what we could call ritual specialists, right? People who know how to work the religious side of things or the spiritual side of things, right? And very often this is very, very practical, right? So it's things like, oh, a plague is hitting. Right, what should we do about this plague? Right, very often there would be, of course, a medical side to it, but also a ritual side, right, a religious side, or people are suffering from hauntings, or so on and so forth, family curses, right, bloodline curses, and so on. So goetic practitioners are largely what filled the gap after you have the collapse of any type of organized religion following the Mycenaean civilization and before the rise of classical Greece. And what we know about them, some of what we know about them, is that they traveled, right? They would go from community to community offering assistance, right? Offering perhaps initiation, right? They may have been very closely related to the mystery traditions that develop in Greece, right? So they may have been offering types of mystical initiation as well. But they had a whole host of very practical concerns, right? If you're being haunted, or ever since your grandfather died, your family has been having terrible luck, right? They were the ones who could figure out, all right, what's going on, right? How do we lay this ghost? How do we put this ghost to rest? Or why is grandpa upset and torturing the family, and so on and so forth, right? So they are a lot like what we find later in sort of folk practitioners, right? Magical folk practitioners, right? There's a similarity to that. There's also been a lot of arguments that there is a type of, although this is a sort of dangerous word to use in this context, but a type of shamanic practice going on there too. So very often you'll hear goetic practitioners identified as, oh, it was ancient Greek shamanism, right? That's sort of a shorthand with obviously all kinds of caveats and things like this, right? But they survive into the rise of classical Greece, right? So you start to have cities develop again, right? You have the develop of the polis, right? These were city-states. You start to have stronger and stronger systems of government, and these systems of government began wanting to control as well, sort of centralize as well religion. Right, and control over things like ritual expertise, right? So you start having city temples, right? Official state priesthoods, and so on. And they're in sharp contrast with these in Plato, he calls them night wandering priests, right? These priests who are wandering from village to village, from city to city, offering various skills and expertise.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know, when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself, talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Very different from the official priest of, let's say, Athena in Athens, who has a government position, arguably. So, that's part of Goetia, right? But the key is that what a Goetic practitioner was dealing with were very local, very often idiosyncratic types of situations and interests, right? A Goetic practitioner wouldn't have been an official priest of Apollo or whomever. They may have had relationships and maybe very dedicated relationships with individual gods or various gods. Right, but they also had to be able to work with a host of unexpected or unfamiliar or unpredictable sort of local spirits, right? Sort of what sometimes gets called in the literature small gods, right? We see this in like the Fae and things like this, right? So these sort of small sort of entities that are more likely than not to be causing trouble with actual people rather than someone actually having a problem with Apollo, right? So you get that as part of Goetia. The argument is, and you had mentioned the PGM, so I should make the move to the PGM, right? There's a lot of debate about how we should interpret, right, the Greek magical papyri, the PGM. And it's a collection of all different works with different origins. So it could be that we have a few different things going on. But there's a debate, are these types of rituals and documents that were being preserved from a temple culture that was beginning to fall apart at the time that we see a lot of the PGM preserved? That's probably part of it, right? Are they working sort of what we would call sort of a grimoire or something like that, right? A working grimoire, right? Are these the notes of an actual practitioner who was traveling around offering services? There's probably an element of that, right? When we think of these magical papyri as the notes of practitioners for hire, and it may have been charitable, who the heck knows, right? But thinking of them as practitioners for hire makes a lot of sense, right? The notes of practitioners for hire. Then we get a strong overlap with what we would have seen in something like Goetic practice, right? You have individual practitioners who are traveling around, finding people in need, offering their assistance, maybe for pay, maybe not, who knows, right? But they are sort of spiritual and ritual experts outside the boundaries of official state religion, right? Of the official sort of religious forces. And yes, yeah, I think that this survives easily into the medieval period for sure, right? I think that there's a strong line, and Jake Stratton Kent and other folks like that have made this argument that there's a strong line to the grimoire tradition, right? That grimoires grow out of this similar type of context and practice.
Could we talk a little bit about the mysteries? The mysteries themselves weren't specifically native to Greece, and how that this tradition may have been a survival from the Baltic regions, and how this has then been transmitted across Europe, which I assume was happened before the Bronze Age collapse, before the Mycenaean period. And then how does this then influence Greek society in regard to necromantic practice or katabasis?
Yeah. I mean, I could be accused of sort of overstating my point earlier when I was talking about the Greek Dark Ages, because it is true that there's very good reasons to think that Goetia has its roots in the Bronze Age. And there's various connections to metalworking that we can talk about here that seem particularly sort of interesting and important. But yes, it's very likely that what we see in these sort of traveling ritual specialists is certain practices, skills, knowledge, perhaps even initiations, right, that come from beyond, you know, Greece. So definitely there are very sort of interesting possibilities and arguments about this. And there are arguments that the Greek mystery traditions, right, the various initiatory mysteries also derive, that many of them derive from outside the boundaries of Greece and were probably brought in by these goetic practitioners, right, by these sort of traveling figures. I mean, I definitely think that is on point for sure. One of the things that's often underappreciated, I think, is how much of an interconnected world the Bronze Age was. Making bronze, just as an example, I'd mentioned metalwork, but making bronze is very, well, I won't say very complicated, but having the materials to make it is very complicated, right? Because where you find some of it, you don't find others, right? So you need a fairly expansive trade network to be producing any amount of serious bronze. And this is one of the arguments for why the Bronze Age collapse may have happened, right? It's still one of these great sort of mysteries. How are we supposed to think about it? So on and so forth. But part of it may be that you had several, you know, very successful, highly developed societies, the Hittites being one of them, Egypt being another, and so on, right? And they were all working with each other in these complex trade sort of systems. And if you start to have some of those systems collapse, everything falls apart very quickly, right? It's not dissimilar from our current sort of global situation, where when you have, you know, trade start to break down in certain key sectors, everyone is dependent on everyone else in a way that easily leads to surprising types of collapse. But when you have this extensive trade network, you also have the trading of ritual knowledge, right? And ritual skills and ritual expertise. So I think that this is part of the way in which we should understand some of these sort of ritual skills being passed on, right? How you get sort of these traveling experts, if that makes some sense.
Are there any textual examples of katabasis from ancient Greece that you think are particularly worthy of attention for those of us interested in engaging with this form of magic?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you just want from ancient Greece? Because, you know, the history of sort of literary examples or mythological examples of katabasis is fascinating, right?
Well, they're quite universal, right?
Yes, yeah, precisely, right? Arguably one of the earliest pieces of literature we have, right, is The Descent of Inanna. And, you know, even though this is a story about a goddess, right? So it's not a normal human katabasis, let's say. It is a story of katabasis, right? It's a story of a goddess sort of going to the underworld and a very distinct process that's involved in that, right? A process of removing things and sort of purification, also a humbling, right? That's involved in this. But yeah, I mean, the most famous literary example in ancient Greece, it happens in the Odyssey. So Odysseus has made friends with the goddess Circe or Circe, and she has advised him that he should go to the underworld and speak to the dead, specifically speak to Tiresias, member of the spirits of the dead in order to find out how to safely get home. And basically, she insists, if you don't do this, you're never going to safely get home. So he goes to the underworld, right? I put it sort of in scare quotes. I know we don't have a video here. But he goes to what's considered sort of the outskirts of the underworld, right? It was sort of a beach right next to the Grove of Persephone, right? So it's understood to be within the boundaries of the underworld, but only on the very sort of limits of it. Now, we do know that other than the official textual version we have in Homer, there were other versions that had him actually travel through the underworld. We know this from Potts and so on and so forth, where we have depictions or descriptions of depictions of him traveling through the underworld. So there were versions that were more openly and obviously catabasis, right? But he goes, and actually the fact that there's some ambiguity here between Odysseus going to the underworld versus calling the spirits to him fits my point, right? He goes to a place that can be understood as the outskirts of the underworld. He summons forth the spirits, and then he meets a whole bunch of spirits, right? The most important one is Tiresias, who, according to Circe, he alone maintains his personality and his mind in death. At the time, well, there's debates about whether or not this was standard at the time, but certainly in Homer, the spirits of the dead do not seem to be much beyond hungry shades. They don't remember who they were or what they were until they're fed blood, right? So Odysseus has to literally hold them off with his sword, only allowing them to drink after he's spoken with Tiresias, and only allowing them to drink when he wants to speak with them. But before they drink from the blood of the offering, they don't know who they are. They don't know who he is, even his own mother, right? They have no sense of themselves. Tiresias, however, has one of his blessings. He got various blessings in life. One of them was to maintain his knowledge and his wisdom and his personality in the afterlife. But so the story of Odysseus is a really famous story of catabasis. That then gets plagiarized, so to speak, by Virgil, right, in the Aeneid. The Aeneid has another very famous story, very famous example of catabasis, where Aeneas, the hero, goes down to the underworld, and it's very similar to the version in the Odyssey, where he has to meet various people and talk with various spirits in order to ensure that his quest is a success. Right. But during the Hellenistic period and also the Roman period, we have some other lesser known examples that are pretty darn interesting. Right. So one of the most dramatic examples, I think, is Seneca. Right. Seneca has his own version of the Oedipus story. And in it, there's a necromantic scene. But I would argue that it's catabasis too, because in this scene, and I include a lengthy quotation from it in the paper, but in this scene, this sort of dark glen in which Tiresias is summoning forth the spirits of the dead becomes the underworld, right? There's this description of the ground ripping open and, you know, the underworld pours out and I think the exact phrase, if I'm remembering right, if this is in Seneca, is that, yeah, so the exact phrase, I just love it, is, "With my own eyes, I saw the bloodless gods and the night that is truly night." All right, so seeing into the underworld as seeing the night, which is truly night. I love that, right? And there are a few others, right? So Lucian, who was a comedian, but Lucian has a few depictions of catabasis too that I think are fairly important. He has one where a person is describing the process and talks about what he had to do to safely engage in this catabasis, and part of what he had to do was carry a musical instrument, the lyre. He had to wear a lion sort of fur cloak, and so on, right? And we'll probably get to talking about why that's interesting. But it's
well, great. Yeah, I mean, my next question is really, we see this motif of descent into the underworld play out in Orpheus and also in Hercules as well. And we see these same items being utilized, the lyre, the lionskin belt. So you mentioned in your essay that often the spirits of the underworld that are being engaged with via necromancy aren't nor have ever been human. So perhaps we should discuss that a little bit. I mean, who are some of these spirits and what roles do they play?
Yeah, I mean, so the interesting thing, the reason why I became fixated on this issue, right, was in thinking again about Goetia and also thinking about grimoire practice, right? And, you know, there are, of course, some examples in grimoires of necromancy, right, where we're trying to contact the dead, speak with the dead, so on and so forth, right? And there's plenty of that in the PGM, right, in the Greek Magical Papyri. But by and large, that's not what we seem to be dealing with, right? If you look at the categories in most, not the categories, the catalogs of spirits in most grimoires, you know, it's not the dead that we seem to be dealing with, right? And my argument partially was that we can take catabasis as the model for a lot of this grimoire practice, especially grimoires that are dealing with what we might call sort of demonic entities, right? So certainly the grimoire that ends up being called the Goetia, right, is a good example. Or Verum, right? Grimoirum Verum, right? The true grimoire is another good example. So if we've got all these spirits, and most of them are not spirits of the dead, although some of them are, right? Every now and then we get like an identification, like this is Cain, right? Of Cain and Abel, right? Things like that. But, you know, most of them do not seem to be spirits of the dead. How does that connect to something like necromancy?
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know, when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself, talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Right. Well, if every act of necromancy is an act of catabasis, of going into the underworld, well, then the main concern of necromancy in terms of protections and in terms of sort of passwords and gatekeeping and all that stuff is not going to be the spirits of the dead, right? The main dangers we're going to face are things like underworld guardians, right? The most famous of which, of course, is Cerberus, right, or Kerberos. I've got a weird thing about the fact that we've transformed the hard K sound in ancient Greek into its soft C's, and it drives me nuts. But you know, I'll use the word that people recognize, right? It's a Cerberus, right? The three-headed dog. It's striking that Cerberus shows up in the grimoires, right? Some of them mention Cerberus specifically, right? The name specifically, and some identify other spirits. So the spirit Nebaros, and there are variations on that, is identified frequently with Cerberus, right? Okay, so we've got underworld guardians, right? The other thing that we have, of course, and this should not be too surprising, but we have gods and goddesses of the underworld, right? For Odysseus to do what he did, for him to speak with the spirits of the dead, he had to first work through Hades and work through Persephone, right? He makes an offering to both of them and he prays to both of them. So we have that as well. We also have these incredibly interesting and dangerous entities that are previous divinities that have been cast down.
Ah, yes, the Titans.
Yeah, exactly. Some of the Titans and folks like that. And Typhon, right, for example, as well. So these are sort of underworld entities that one could conceivably interact with, right? Certainly some of my favorite parts of the Greek magical papyri deal with dealing with Kronos and dealing with Set and some spirits who could conceivably be identified as these sort of overthrown, sort of fallen divinities in the underworld. So all of this then puts ritual practice into context, right? That, look, if I want to talk to, you know, grandma, I also have to be concerned, right? Not that grandma is going to try to do me harm, because she probably won't, right? And not, although this is a major concern in a lot of traditions, not that something will come along and pretend to be her, or that some level of deception. But first and foremost, I have to be concerned that when I enter the underworld, I don't get eaten by Cerberus, right? I don't get in some way injured by the guardians, right? That I don't enrage the wrong thing, that I don't anger the wrong thing, that I'm allowed to pass. And that's a big deal, right? Being allowed to pass through. Because you mentioned, you know, Orpheus and Hercules or Heracles and Odysseus, right? These are sort of the three big ones, right? The three humans we know who have done it, right? Who have crossed into the underworld and come back safely. And each of them had to figure out their own way of doing it, right? But they do establish a tradition of living human access to the underworld. And I think that that's really the important point, right? This tradition of living human access to the underworld.
Before I ask you about how this sort of changes the definition of what magic actually is in the generic zeitgeist of modern day practical magic, I really want to talk about the way in which the dominance of Platonic and Aristotelian hermeneutical models or ontologies of occult practice have in many ways whitewashed these far more archaic pagan necromantic practices. For those of our listeners who have read Agrippa and are familiar with the 19th century magical revival put forth by lodge orders such as the Golden Dawn, they will likely understand that these moments in history represent bottlenecks in the way in which esoteric practices were, for all intents and purposes, cherry-picked and recodified to produce a new synthesis. They defined the narrative in many ways of what would develop forward into the modern day. Could you elaborate on that? I mean, I know it's a huge question, but
I talk about this a lot. So yeah, for sure. I think I can definitely elaborate.
Yes, specifically the way in which the Platonic conceptualization of magic, and you mentioned before there was this polarity between ancient Goetic and theurgic practices. So could you elaborate further on that topic?
Yes, yeah, absolutely, right. My interest, a large part of my interest and a lot of what I do has to do with the oral period in ancient Greece, right? That period without writing, which is why I had fixated earlier on the sort of Dark Age period, right? That period without writing in Greece. And part of the reason why is that there is certain ways of thinking that writing allows us to engage in that become so natural that they seem obvious. And they are not natural and not easy without writing. So what do I mean here? What I mean here is abstraction, right? Abstract thoughts. And we see this, just to give a quick example, right? We see this in Plato all over the place when you look at the actual dialogues, right? Socrates goes up to someone and says, you know, what is courage? And the person gives them a concrete example. They say courage is when Achilles is on the field of battle and does X, Y, and Z, right? And Socrates has to correct them and say, no, that's not what I'm looking for. I don't want an example. Now, what he wants is something like an abstract universal definition. But what's striking is that he doesn't have the words for that, right? And the things he says at this moment are as torturous in the Greek as they are in the English. And I think that this is really telling, right? Socrates has to look at these people and say, no, what I want is I want you to tell me what courage is in itself by itself. which is an incredibly unnatural, weird, torturous phrase in ancient Greece. And almost inevitably, the people Socrates are talking to go, what the hell are you talking about? Right? And then Socrates has to say something like, well, if I'm talking about bees, and if this is a bee and that is a bee, I want to know what makes them all bees, right? So he has to jump through so many hoops to get people to try to understand that what he wants is a definition, an abstract definition, something that seems so natural to us. And the people of ancient Athens, classical Athens, have no idea what he's talking about. Right. And the reason why is that within an oral society, now granted, there had been writing for several hundred years at this point, but writing takes a while to absolutely dominate the, let's say, psychological makeup of a culture. Right? So within an oral society, the way you understand what a thing is through concrete examples. And very often these concrete examples are couched in terms of stories because they have to be memorable. And this is why epic poetry is so important, right? It can be memorized and passed down generation to generation to generation, right? And this becomes the standard for how to define, quote unquote, something, right? You define it through important examples, right? Achilles is courage in this moment, right? And Tiresias is divine religious wisdom in this moment, right? And so on. Okay, so how does this all sort of connect to the issue, right? What happens with Plato, and then it's very hard to overstate the influence of Platonism, is that Platonism becomes the foundation of most of the metaphysical and religious and spiritual thought that follows after it that has direct connection with it. So it's incredibly influential on Christianity. It's influential in medieval interpretations of things like Judaism and Islam and so on and so forth. So what goes on? Plato was one of the first major thinkers within sort of the Greek context and then the sort of the wider sort of Mediterranean context to be trying to develop the idea of abstract entities as real, right? In other words, the good is something and exists. The beautiful is something and exists, right? And the people Socrates are talking to would think, look, like there's beauty, right? Like Aphrodite is beautiful. But if you want me to tell you what the beautiful is, I don't even know what that means, right? It's sort of meaningless, right? Okay. Now, this becomes the sort of dominance of abstract characteristics becomes the framework for a lot of the metaphysical systems that we then end up using. I know this is sort of largely what Agrippa does, right? That we then end up using to understand occult and magical practice, right? So Agrippa is a whole compendium of abstract correspondences, right? This thing and this thing, right? So the gold and the sun, right? An easy one, but so on and so forth, right? We get these correspondences. And then usually that's grounded in some sort of metaphysical concept of, let's say, energy or powers or virtues, right? So gold has the virtue of the sun, right? There's some sort of force that they share and so on, right? Eventually you get these sort of vast systems with the lodge systems of magic, where you could say something like, well, the number six and gold and the sun, and you just sort of keep going. And you get books like 777, right? You know, these sort of collections of correspondences. Okay. So it's very common then to think about ritual procedure, ritual elements in terms of this. So the example I use in the paper is the lion skin belt. So the lion skin belt is mentioned as an important element in grimoire practice. And the question is why? Right? Like, why does this matter? And the standard answer derived from Platonism would be, look, the lion corresponds to either the sun, that's the most obvious one, or maybe martial or sort of Mars elements. Obviously, the lion has some sort of violent force, right? But it also sort of has the gold of the sun. So the lion skin belt is meant to capture this protective element of both the sun and Mars, and thus protect us from the dangers of the spirits and sort of force the spirits to obey us. Okay, right. And then we can do that with everything, right? Why this stone? Why this herb? Why this incense? Abstract energies. Whole systems of abstract energies. There are older ways to think about that, right? That's why I pointed out sort of some of the material in Lucian, right? Lucian has a character who says, look, to go to the underworld, I had to wear a lion fur cloak. Why did he have to wear a lion fur cloak? It wasn't because of any correspondence with the sun or with Mars. It was because Hercules wore it. But notice the difference, right? It's not to say that it's because wearing that cloak puts us in touch with the abstract energy of Hercules, right? So it's not just another variation on the energy of the sun type stuff. It's instead that there's an ongoing tradition, a tradition of people wearing lion fur when entering the underworld. Or, you know, we could look at Orpheus with the lyre or Odysseus and so on and so forth, right? There's an ongoing story that we can step into and become part of.
So it's like a mythic narrative.
Yes, that's exactly it, right? The mythic narrative that we make ourselves part of, that we become part of. There's obviously surviving elements of this all over the grimoires, but very often we get these sort of torturous modern interpretations of it, where it's like, yeah, it says to wear a crown like you're Solomon, and that's because the spirits will mistake you for Solomon because they don't have a great sense of time or something like this. And that's a very sort of torturous reinterpretation. It could just be that no. Like, we are stepping into the ongoing mythical story of what Solomon did. And like Solomon did, so do we, right? Like Hercules did, so do we, right? We're becoming part of that story. We're becoming part of that living sort of story. I think it's one of the, it ends up sounding poetic to us, but I don't think it would have been poetic in a, poetic being sort of romantic, I guess we should say, or simply flowery. But it wouldn't have been in an oral context to say something like, look, stories are alive and are ongoing. I mean, that's what, you know, a country, for example, is, right? It's an ongoing story. A good one or a bad one or both, or who knows, right? And we are living out our lives as part of those stories. And the same thing goes for practices of magic, right? They're ongoing stories that we step into, that we become part of. And by becoming part of them, it comes with certain benefits, it comes with certain risks, with certain prices, right? There are debts that we didn't create ourselves, but that exist. And by stepping into a certain type of story, we may be taking on some of those debts too, right? So I think that this is an alternative way to think about a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. Related to that, there is, with the rise of abstraction, the creation of sort of various world dualisms. So one of the famous things that Plato did was propose that there was a way that things can exist without.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know, when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself, talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Let's say body. I don't want to say matter because materialism sort of comes a bit later. But without body, right? That ideas can exist in a way that is higher and purer, more pure than our bodily existence, right? And that there's a part of us, call it the psuche, right? The mind slash soul, right? Psuche means both in ancient Greek. That there's a part of us that can be free of our body, and then it can be purified. And if it's purified enough, it can reach the purest level, right? And that purest level is pure abstraction, right? That's where you find the beautiful, not beautiful things, but the beautiful, right? And so on and so forth. So this is sort of a two-world dualism. Now, what's important here is that the land of the dead, right, where the dead go, gets further and further away in this sense, right? So you end up, for example, and this a lot of this comes out of Aristotle and then Ptolemy, and you know, it's developed during the Hellenistic period, but you end up with the idea that, look, the planets are perfect. The moon clearly is an in-between, right? It shifts in its being, and we can see imperfections on it. And then the Earth is this messy, sort of muddy, earthy type place, right? And so up there with the perfect planets, there are perfect sort of non-bodily things. And that the path of the soul is through the moon, which is this in-between space, to the perfections beyond, right? This is where we get the idea of the, I guess, the sublunary realm, right? The realm below the moon, and what you could call, although it's not as common a term, but the superlunary sort of realm, right? The realm of perfection beyond the moon. And then you have, you know, very, very old goddesses like Hecate, right? Identified with the moon, and people say, oh, she's the gatekeeper of the dead, and so on and so forth. But in Platonism, it becomes interpreted in this way where, you know, she's the doorway through which things pass from pure perfect abstraction into bodily sort of imperfection and back and forth, right? Whereas she has a much older version that, ironically enough, is closer to how she shows up, much closer to how she shows up in the PGM, right? In the magical papyri. Even though the magical papyri come after a lot of these changes became dominant, right? I've argued that what you see in the magical papyri, I don't want to go too far with this, this is slightly tangential, but that what you see in the magical papyri is a type of fighting back against Platonism, right? It may not have been fully conscious, but that there's a sort of anti-Platonic sort of fight going on here, where people are trying to say, look, like there's another way, an older way to conceive of goddesses like Hecate or the spirits of the dead.
Well, just the existence of the Ficciones, really, yeah. Alone is a perfect example of an alternative, because you're pushing lead into the earth in a graveyard. You know, that's not a Platonic practice.
or throwing them into wells, right? I mean, that whole idea that, I mean, this is an important part of my essay, right? The conception of place, right? So within a pre-Platonic view, the dead are everywhere, right? They're all around us. They're very, very sort of present. But also, the land of the dead is not that far, right? That's why I mentioned there were temples in ancient Greece where you would be in a cave, and it was understood that, look, like if you keep going down that cave, you'd enter the underworld, right? Like this is sort of your in the foyer, right? You're just over the boundary into the underworld. And very often these caves sort of had bad air further down, right? So it was quite literally the case, and people were aware of this, right? Like, yeah, that's why you die when you go into this cave, because you're entering death, right? So, you know, the land of the dead was very, very present. That's why you could like bury something to get it to the underworld, or toss it into a well, or bury it in the graveyard. Professor Porterfield, Charles Porterfield, has this wonderful way of talking about graveyards as embassies of the underworld, right? So the way that an embassy is both, you know, let's say the French embassy in England, right? The embassy is on English soil, but technically it's France, right? When you're on its grounds, you're in France. Same type of thing, right? That graveyards and cemeteries are embassies of the underworld. When you're there, you're technically in the underworld. And, you know, if you do the wrong thing, if you step wrong, you can get into all kinds of trouble, right? That's why there's sort of standard practices and traditions around how to behave in cemeteries and graveyards.
That's a really interesting point. I really like that. I might use that myself from now on. I like it. I want to talk a little bit more about the geography involved. Because I think when we're talking about geography, we're not necessarily talking about, we're talking about a landscape, but we're talking about a landscape which exists in this mythic space between, like, as you were just saying, between places in this embassy sort of location. But I mean, we're also talking about like mythic geographies or mythic narratives which exist in materia. Like the lion skin belt has a narrative that exists within it. It has a geography. It has characters. It has a story. It has all of this. Oh, I'm struggling to find the right word. It has all of this meaning condensed within it. Really, the definition of magic as we're discussing it right now is about engaging with those narratives, as opposed to literally saying, well, this plant has this materia and I conjure this super celestial being to, you know, to descend to this location onto the object, to charge the object, as it were. We're talking about completely flipping that model upside down.
Yes, yeah. And I think there's some implications of that, right? So I want to make one point, but without sort of spending too much time in sort of the high philosophical realm. But in my book, True to the Earth, Pagan Political Theology, which has a lot to do with this sort of trying to reconstruct this oral view of reality and sort of a metaphysics of oral societies type thing. But in the course of that, I argue that what's going on here? So I talked about living stories, right? There's a way to make that a lot more robust and a bit less romantic, right? Because what I'm talking about is animism, right? Everything is understood as living. And the base level is, and this is where it's like high philosophy, and I don't want to get too far into it, but is an event ontology. In other words, what is really real are ongoing events. So what a thing is, a living thing, me, you, any of us, right? What we are is we're these living ongoing events, the event of, you know, Cadmusing, right? the event of matting, right? This ongoing event. And we can think of that very coherently as a story, right? And then all you have to add to that is that we're obviously, I'd mentioned nations, right? We're part of other stories, right? Our stories overlap with others, weave in and out of each other, but also we're part of much larger stories. And those stories are part of larger stories, right? The story of the entire planet and so on, right? You get this nestling. And if all these things are living entities, right? That's sort of the animist perspective. Then what you have, if you think about, like right now in front of me, I have, you know, I know you can't see, I know we don't have video, but one of my favorite chunks of Bloodstone, right? And, you know, if we think about Bloodstone, there are different stories connected to it. And if you just think in terms of abstract correspondence, there are different correspondences. And very often when we think in terms of correspondence, people get frustrated because they're like, well, what's the right one, right? Like what officially is its planetary correspondence? But if you think in terms of living stories, you see why that's so mistaken, because it's part of several stories. Right, Bloodstone's a great example because in ancient Greece it was very often identified with, you know, the blood of sometimes Cronos, sometimes Uranos, heaven, right? Cronos's father, the blood of Titans, right? So when various gods went to war, blood fell on the earth and they got preserved in the Bloodstone. An alternative story that comes a bit later is that when Jesus was crucified, his blood fell on the stone, right? And this is the blood of Jesus. Right. And so on. Right. There are variations and variations. Right. So you have a materia, and the materia is several different, many, I mean, perhaps countless different living stories to it. So which is right? None of them are right. Just like, you know, I'm me and I'm also a husband and I'm also a professor and I'm also a son and all kinds of stuff. Right. All these stories are part of me. So the way I think about it in terms of practice, and I think I stole this, at least this way of describing it, from both Dr. Alexander Cummins and from Professor Charles Porterfield. I don't know which I got it from first, but you know that's the way these things go. But one way that I think about working with materia is that you have to remind it what it is for this purpose, right? So, I mean, what it is you're using it for, right? Which part of its story are you awakening, Right. Which part of its living, ongoing sort of existence matters to you at this moment, right? And is important for this thing. And sometimes I do that very directly, right? I'll pick something up and say, you are this, right? Like, you are the blood of heaven, fallen to the earth, right? And I remind it what it is, and I remind it what I need it for. And the amazing thing is, by the way, so there's two other points I want to make about this. One, this happens, this is really useful in life too. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but I've had experiences where like a friend of mine has come to me after being in like an abusive relationship, and they're suffering from various, problems because of that. And it can be really powerful to remind them who they are that they've forgotten, right? What parts of their story have they lost touch with? Right. And there's a type of empowerment to that, and being like, remember, you're the person who did this, right? You're the person who had that experience. You're the person who overcame this other thing, right? So we're awakening aspects of their story that have fallen sort of silent, right? That are less lively at that moment, and we're enlivening them. The other thing I want to say about this is in terms of divination, I think thinking about divination can clarify a lot of this stuff too. Because I think one way to understand what divination does, and then how we can use divination in our magical practice. I do a tarot reading, or I'm using geomancy, or whatever the case may be, whatever your divinatory practice may be. When we use divination, part of what it does is it tells us what kind of story we're in. Right. So, like, what's the story right now? I thought that this was, a fun adventure story. Turns out it's a tragedy, and the cards are like, hey, like, you don't see the tragic turn coming, but it's there, right? You're not in the kind of story you think you're in, right? And actually, there's a useful way to think about a tragedy as a literary form in terms of people misunderstanding the story they're in, right? So, divination at its best, I think, can tell us what kind of story we're in, but can also tell us one of two things, right? Because there's always the two approaches. Either how to play our part in this story the best, right? Like, how do you make the best out of the story you're in? Or sometimes, and sometimes in dramatic situations, this is necessary, how to change the story, right? How do you jump out of the tragedy and be like, no, I don't want to be in that kind of story. We're not always free to make that choice, but sometimes we are, and a good divination practice tells us when we can make that choice. Anyway, that's all sort of stuff dealing with sort of living stories and an animism based on the idea of living stories.
One of the cruxes of your argument in this piece is what you call the glitch in the Platonic model, and about how the personality of specific entities, the spirits of the dead, supposedly the closer you get beyond, the further you get to the source, if that's the Platonic idea of the source, the less personality that you have, and yet we're left with these, planets and constellations and stars and all sorts, which ultimately have personality or very deep narrative meaning. And yeah, could you elaborate on that further?
Yeah, for sure. I think about this as the problem of personality, and I think you can look at it two different ways. One is it's a problem about immortality for me, right? Personal immortality. And on the other side, it's a problem about my relationship with divinity. So, and this is you see this in Platonism, right? Call it Neoplatonism if you want, or Middle Platonism, or whatever the case may be. But the way that Platonism ended up being developed into really a religious philosophy and a religious movement during the Hellenistic and then Roman periods, right? What people want is not generally.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
But platonically informed religions can or do give them. So if you're in a true sort of rich polytheist context, it is totally reasonable to expect to have some sort of personal relationship with the gods. And this can be for good or ill, right? It could be that a god just hates you for some unknown reason and is like, you know what? I'm out to get you, right? And I mean, the whim of the gods is part of their personality, right? That they're hard to deal with. But it makes sense. And if you look at the way in which examples of prayer in ancient Greece, for example, there are models of prayer. And one of the models of prayer is, I've given you these things. We get this in the Iliad, by the way, very early on, right? You've got a priest who prays to Apollo and says, if I have ever given you any offerings, all the times I've built you temples, all the times I've done this stuff, now give to me. Right. So there's this idea that, like, you've bribed them, right? It's not pretty, but it is a living relationship. It's a real relationship. And you could have a personal relationship. And people want, it's very clear. I mean, look at the history of Christianity and you know, I mean, all of our big monotheistic religions. People want a personal relationship with their divinities. Right? Problem is that if you take Platonic theology really seriously, the perfect things can have personality, right? Plato was huge on this. I'm just about to teach the Euthyphro tomorrow in my classes, actually. And the Euthyphro is really good about this. But, you know, you also see this in the Republic and elsewhere. If something's perfect, it can't change. And if something's perfect, it can't need or want or desire, right? All of these things. And it might not seem obvious that that's a problem, but if you think that you can make God angry and God is perfect, then you are mistaken. You cannot anger a perfect God because that gives you power over it. Similarly, if you think that God is happy when you are well, right, that God wishes well for you, no, right? To wish something is further to be a lack in the perfect thing. So the perfect thing cannot want anything, desire anything, demand anything, give anything, right? They can't change and they can't have anything like what we would think of as personality. And Plato is really stringent about this. Then you get Platonism where they're like, well, what are we going to do? So they end up with these middle terms, this multiplication of middle terms where you're like, well, you know, there's daimons, there's these, like, you know, the medium gods, the middle gods, and they're not the highest perfect things, but they're still there and they can have personality and so on and so forth. But these are all signs of their imperfection, right? Signs that they're not truly divine. Okay. So there's that, right? So you kind of have to create these middle terms and multiply them to satisfy the people. No one is satisfied by praying to what ends up being called the God of the philosophers, the true, complete, perfect thing. The true, complete, perfect thing is empty, right? I call it this sort of inhuman monster. It's totally empty. There's nothing you can say about it. It will not reassure you in the dark of the night. It just won't, right? On the other hand, we want immortality, right? There's this desire to know that there's something after death. When you connect perfection with increased abstraction, and this is basically what Plato does, and it gets taken up in a lot of monotheistic theology after that. When you connect perfection to increased abstraction, so the good and the perfect and the beautiful in themselves, by themselves, right? Then to achieve sort of the highest thing that is possible for us is to utterly lose ourselves, right? So something may live on, my psuche may live on, but my psuche, my soul is going to be so purified at that point, so perfect that it's not going to resemble me at all. Because the same things I just said about God apply to me, if I am going to near those levels of perfection, right? I can't change. And this is a big thing in Plato, for example, right? Socrates is, there are all these weird stories about Socrates. So there's a story about when he's in the military and he gets lost in thought and he stands, I think it's for 2 days outside in the weather, unmoving because he's lost in thought. And the implication is that he's connecting with the perfect things, right? He's becoming more and more like the good, the true, and the beautiful, right? Similarly, Socrates never gets drunk. He can drink all he wants. It's not like he abstains from alcohol, but he never gets intoxicated. And it's because he is closer to these perfect, unchanging things. So you can imagine, bring that to the highest extent where we truly achieve immortality and we'll never change, we'll never alter. But that's not us, right? Like, we care about things. We want things to be different than they are. We, you know, all of these aspects that make our personality get lost. You see this, by the way, right? This isn't just me sort of taking Plato and trying to force it onto to monotheism. You see it at the very end of the Divine Comedy, right? Dante, at the end of the Divine Comedy, sees what's called the Rose of God, right? He has this vision of God, and it's this vision of all the saints and the most blessed dissolving into nothing but one perfect rose, right? And the idea is that they've all dissolved to perfection. And the thing is that when you dissolve into perfection, you don't get to enjoy that. You're not there anymore. Right? There's no you there. So this is the problem of perfection, a problem of personality, sorry.
It's a fascinating, fascinating conversation. And it's really good, I think, to hear you express so many ideas that I've personally had myself as well. So, you know, and, you know, I mentioned Dr. Al Cummings before as well. And I think very much on the same page with many of his ideas as well here, when he mentioned the reason, recently you mentioned to me why the reason the Psalms maybe are important is because they're haunted. And it's not just because you're reading the Psalm, your voice is being added to everybody else who ever read that psalm at that time in that mythic space that you've created. So yes, it's this really fascinating concept, really wonderful conversation. How can we as practitioners of necromancy attempt to reclaim and explore pre-Christian and pre-Platonic aspects of this tradition and engage with this force of myth and narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've touched upon a few of these things, but I would recommend to sort of respectfully put aside the tables of correspondences. I think that digging into myth and folklore, and it doesn't have to be ancient Greek or whatnot. I mean, Lord knows, it's much better to dig into the folklore of where you are too, especially if you want to understand the living stories that are part of your landscape, right, of your home. But, you know, to look at the mythological meanings and stories and the folkloric sort of meanings and stories of the tools you use, right, of the place you are, right, of those sort of elements, right? So here's a random example that I've recently become more and more infatuated with, and I'll probably talk more about in the future, right? I think I'm going to have to write about it in the future. But the history of the black-handled knife, which appears in many different sort of grimoires, I know you had held up earlier before we started the Hygromantia, right? And there's a discussion in the intro to the Hygromantia about the fact that, you know, as far as we know historically, and we may discover something new, but it's sort of the oldest version of the Key of Solomon that we have is Greek. Right, it comes from the Greek context, and there is a long-standing Cretan tradition of black-handled knives. Right, they're part of folk practice there, and it's not that they're being informed by the grimoires. It seems very likely that they predate, and that, you know, the what becomes the black-handled knife all throughout Europe and the rest of the world and so on and so forth is a local Cretan folkloric magical tradition. So, you know, if you've got a black-handled knife or you're developing one, it might make sense to look into Cretan folklore, right? I'm not saying you have to, right? There are other stories that the black-handled knife features in as well, but there's that kind of thing. So I do think that all of this is important, right? To think in terms of the myth, the stories that are ongoing, right? That you're stepping into.
And so really, like, the last big one that I wanted to mention was like this idea that from the perspective of a person practicing a grimoire in the modern day, when we create the circle, we have this very specific way in which I think it's important from what you're saying from your essay that we can adapt the way in which we engage with this circle. It's not simply lines or chalk on the floor with names written in it. There are, in many grimoires, there's like the spirits of the seasons, the sun and the moon, which the circle itself adapts and evolves and changes depending on what season you're in. And so even from that, the circle itself can be seen to have a narrative. You know, many other circles don't have that. There's specific types of magical circles that do. But even the really very simple magical circles that we find, for instance, like the one from the one that Jake Strang Kent proposes to use in his version of the True Grimoire, which is a circle with a triangle in the center. Very simple, doesn't involve much, if anything. There's not much complexity there. But when we step into that circle, we are stepping into, as you've put it, an embassy space, an overlapping region of the underworld. And I just think that's really fascinating. That's a really interesting way of engaging with the practice itself, as opposed to, I just need a circle. I need to stand in a circle and I need to read X, Y, and Z names out. Yes, it's fascinating. I really, really like this. Yeah.
Yeah. Two things related to that. One slightly tangential, but I just have to mention it. I've become more and more obsessed with thinking in terms of the winds, right? And the directional winds and how like heavily place specific that is, right? Because different winds are like, I'm on the East Coast of the US. Northeast winds are people may not know this. I grew up working on a fishing boat, but Northeast winds are the worst winds you can get in terms of storms, right? They bring 3 or 4 day storms. They make the ocean sort of unnavigable, right? I mean, they're cold, they're dangerous, etc. But it's not like that everywhere, right? So like the characteristic of the winds is so local. And yeah, there are ways of organizing a circle around the winds, and that's going to differ, right? So even as simple as like, when you have something like elemental correspondences to the directions, people have been debating forever, right? You know, is West associated with water because this is a European tradition? And if you're on the East Coast of the US, shouldn't East be associated with water? And so on and so forth, right? I'm not taking a stand on that one way or another, but I do think that we can think about these things in terms of local realities and local mythologies too. But also, in the other point about the circle is that, yeah, when I was thinking about what's the real outcome of claiming that every practice of necromancy is a catabasis, part one of the major outcomes of that claim is that there's no way to insulate yourself from the experience of catabasis, right? Like, that's what you have to be going through, right? So you think about the standard way that people think about the magical circle as a wall, as a way to protect themselves, as a way of insulating themselves from what they're calling outside of it. And I think that this sort of sets all of that on its head, right? Because you begin to see the ritual space and the circle as a way of establishing an embassy, a gateway. Right. So the circle becomes the place of danger. Right. And there are protections and there's ways to navigate it, but it becomes the place in which you are exposing yourself to the risk. And that's an important part of the ritual practice. I think that's an important part of what's going on. I think something is lost if you don't appreciate that sort of the circle as a gateway. I also think that we have interesting survivals, and I talk about a few of them, of sort of the tricky way. It can be tricky to do this, right? So let's say, right now I want to do some sort of necromantic ritual here in my room. how do I make this space an embassy, right? How do I sort of make that catabasis? What I've frequently done, and you know, there are examples of this in like Scott's The Discovery of Witchcraft and other places, is sort of a two-part process, right? One is to actually go to a cemetery or a graveyard, right? It helps at this point to have a spirit of the dead that you work with who's buried there or something like that, right? To have an ongoing relationship. In other words, to be friends with an ambassador, maybe not the ambassador, but to be friends with an ambassador there, and to start the process there, right? And then when you return home, right, you've established the beginning of the process. This can also be why things like grave dirt and cemetery dirt can be important, right? And other materia, right? I have a living ivy plant that was taken from a cutting from an important grave in a cemetery that was important for me. And it's still alive. And, you know, I've had it for years. And that's an ongoing living connection to that cemetery and that grave. Now, you want to be careful with that kind of stuff, right? Because you are purposefully haunting yourself, right? You're haunting your space, and you want to do that thoughtfully and carefully. But I think that's an important part of the process. Yeah,
I absolutely love that. That's beautiful. That's really, really lovely. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for sharing that. finally, Cadmus, do you have anything that you're working on at the moment that you'd like to share with the audience? And is there anything that you're obsessed with at the moment?
Yeah, so first something I'm working on. I have a new book that will be coming out soon-ish, right? To be determined, but it will be coming out through Hadean Press, and it is on necromancy. It's called Learning from Legendary Practitioners. It might change, who knows? Title may shift, but for now it's Learning from Legendary Practitioners. And the basic idea is that each chapter of this book will look at a sort of famous or important, very often mythological practitioner of magic, will sort of do a careful historical, literary, and sometimes even archaeological deep dive into who they likely were, what we know about them, and so on. So there's a chapter, for example, on Circe. There's a chapter on Tiresias. But there's also some chapters on some, there's a chapter that deals with some much more recent witches in Scotland. But anyway, right, these legendary practitioners, so we attempt to sort of uncover to the best of our ability, sort of carefully, who they are. And then I explain sort of how I went about contacting them through actual necromancy, what I learned from them when I contacted them. And very often it's a very interesting process where they are correcting all kinds of mistakes that I made in my interpretation of the data or in my expectations. In one case, and this is actually something I love. In one case, I had already developed a working relationship with one of these figures, and they had told me all kinds of stuff that made no sense to me. And then when I started this project more consciously and I started doing the research, I discovered some things through archaeology that make what I'd been told previously make perfect sense. And I'm like, that's why that was good. Like, now it all makes sense.
I love it when that happens.
Yeah, it's amazing, right? So the book is sort of meant to be both a fairly complete lesson on necromancy as I approach it, right? But scattered throughout the book, right? It's not sort of chapter by chapter, this is how you do it. But also this really robust and interesting engagement with the history and mythology of these really important figures, with the added bonus of this is what it was like when I met them and what they were like, right? And what they want me to tell you, right? Because some of them had very specific things they wanted dictated. So that will be coming out from Hadean somewhere in the near future. Don't quite know where, when. The other thing in terms of obsessions is that I have a class coming up for the Salem Witchcraft and Folklore Spring Agora, right? So they're having a spring version in March of the Salem Witchcraft and Folklore Festival. And that class is on ancient tomb cults. So this past summer, I did a class for them on hero worship. And in the course of that, I became obsessed with this distinction between ancestor worship, hero worship, and tomb cults. And a lot of the research on tomb cults is fairly recent and has been largely, it's sort of a distinction that was overlooked for hundreds of years when thinking about things like hero worship and ancestor worship. So currently I'm obsessed with tomb cults and I'm doing a lot of research on that subject.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading whatever you produce on that. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, so some of that, quite a bit of that research will show up in a chapter in the book I mentioned. But also I'm teaching a class on it to the Salem Witchcraft and Folklore Spring Agora. And that's online, so anyone can attend it.
Okay, and we'll include the details for all of your books, your articles, and courses in the description at the end of the end of the show. I've really enjoyed talking to you today. This has been absolutely fantastic, Cadmus. Thank you so much for coming onto the show today.
Yeah, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Cadmus discussing his fantastic essay, Every Necromantia is a Catabasis, Ancient Insights for Contemporary Goetic Practice, which is published by Hadean Press in Part 5 of the ongoing anthology series Conjure Codex, the link to which can be found in the description below. Another fantastic conversation, adding more definition and dimension to this emerging redefinition of what we call magic. It is apparent that the further we look back in history, the more we are forced to confront the idea that our modern concepts of ritual practice have departed significantly from their earlier modalities. I really enjoyed the way Cadmus described graveyards as embassies and how the circle becomes a liminal space in which the world of the living and the underworld overlap. We needn't descend fully or bodily, but we find ourselves within this space which allows actions to take place on either side. This modality instead engaging with the circle, not as a simple barrier preventing evil from entering, but perhaps something closer to a diving bell, protecting us from immediate harm. But as Cadmus says, it becomes instead the space in which we are exposed to risk. I am particularly impressed by our discussion on the idea that abstraction of thought concerning materia wasn't conceptualized by predominantly oral cultures in the same manner in which we take for granted in the modern day, but that it was the living myths and stories of, say, the lionskin belt being worn by Heracles or Orpheus with his lyre that were the source of power, as opposed to the now ubiquitous concept of magical correspondences as presented in Agrippa and the Golden Dawn. As Cadmus puts it, there is an ongoing tradition or a narrative which flows through the materia, and that it is this myth which is tapped into by the sorcerer during their rites of catabasis. The same goes for our explorations of Solomonic or Cyprianic magic in the modern day, whereby we are stepping into that river of history or of story, myth, and narrative, which has been ongoing now for centuries, if not millennia, and becoming part of it, as opposed to role-playing as a dead magician. Finally, the notion that there are no capital T true correspondences, and that it is up to us, really, to wake up our materia and remind it of its purpose by repeating its myths, its stories, its narrative. I think this is by far the most beautiful part of this emerging recontextualization of what it is to enact magic. As for our podcast, I am very happy to announce that we have now made it over 1,000 subscribers. I'm so grateful for all the feedback I've received from my friends and peers, and look forward to doubling this number within the coming year. With your help, likes, and shares, we can continue to get the voice of Hadean heard, introducing more people to alternative narratives at the bleeding edge of occult practice. Please subscribe if you haven't already and check out the links in the description to both Conjure Codex and Cadmus's book True to Earth, as well as his upcoming course at Salem Witchfest. Thank you all very much for listening, and I will see you again in the next one.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.